Please turn off all cell phones. In addition, please refrain from using cell phones anywhere inside the building so as not to interfere with the taping of the meeting. Thank you. The Pacific Group is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all members of the community are welcome to attend. The single most important aspect of AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Therefore, only alcoholics actually participate in our meetings. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful to you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Good evening. My name is Maria, and I am an alcoholic. Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers and a main speaker. Our first 10-minute speaker is Jessica D.
Hi, Jessica, alcoholic. My sobriety date is December 6th, 2014. And Kimberly Keith is my sponsor, and Pacific Group has always been my home group, but I feel kind of like a fraud being here and speaking because I have been not great about coming to this meeting in person. So I'll probably get a hiss, which I said, but I'm really happy to be here and happy to be at a meeting in person, albeit masked. So everyone said, talk to the newcomer. And so I will tell you guys what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So what it was like, I grew up, you know, in a really kind of normal suburban New Jersey childhood of, you know, nice parents who are still together. I'm one of 4 girls, but nothing bad happened to me growing up, but I placed a lot of, you know, I made everything bad on myself because I was very dramatic. And I compared when you grow up with 3 sisters, all you do is compare yourself to each other. So that's something that plagues me to this day of like, who's better than who, who's this. And that's something that really is a huge part of my alcoholism of this person's better than me, or I'm better than this person. But basically my drinking started I didn't drink a lot in high school. Didn't really find drinking until I went to college. And I remember having a moment of being like, oh, if I drink, I can really be myself. And it was like a feeling of like that breathing a sigh of relief of being like, oh, I can be outgoing. I can be really funny. I can be like that bubbly person that I always wanted to be, but I always wanted to be an extrovert, but I feel like I've always been like a reluctant introvert. But I remember that moment, and alcohol really helped me get out of my shell, which I've heard from the podium many, many times. And it started out pretty innocent as just like partying, but then it got in years after college, and becoming an adult, it started to get kind of, you know, scary. I moved to LA shortly after college, but, you know, I lived in New York, when I was in my early 20s, and there was one night that like should have been a wake up call where I like ended up in Newark and had no idea how. And I was like, how did I take the path? If anyone is like familiar with like the transportation system, it was like, did I take the path? Like, how did I get here? But like a very nice man when I came to was like, you looked at me and I don't know who he is. Or when he said, you really need to be careful. A girl like you shouldn't be doing this. And that of course was like years before I stopped drinking, years before I even felt that there was a problem. But I moved to LA and things just got worse. And drinking for me and alcohol to me was a way for me to not grow up. And it was a way for me to kind of stay in this kind of halted adolescence of not having to deal with reality, of not having to just get a hold of my life. And I was living like I just wanted to live this glamorous life. And it wasn't glamorous. I had a job in entertainment, but I would just go to these parties for work and I would get blackout drunk and make a fool out of myself. And that's not really that glamorous. It's pretty like, it's not cute anymore is what it is. But that happened for many years. And it just got worse where I would be like leaving work and I'd have to stop and get a bottle of wine that I couldn't wait to get home to drink. Like I'd have to drink it. I mean, many of us have been there where you open up a bottle, where you have a wine opener in the car and like a plastic cup. Like, that's not like cool. But that was what it was getting to. And there was one, I started dating this guy who I met blackout drunk at a party. And I don't know how or what he saw in me, because it clearly was not, there wasn't much attractiveness there. I, at that point, I was pretty much like a shell of myself. I had my hands shook. I was never not hungover. I always had a slight tremor. I never felt good. My skin was probably really gross. You know, I was like a little fat. I hate that word. I shouldn't use that from the podium, but you know, and I met this guy who liked me and I started dating him. And, I had a really scare. He was like, you know, I love being with you, but I, you know, you pass out in cabs all the time and I can't wake you up. And I'd be like, yeah, this is just this is like, I know I drank a little too much last night. And, that started happening. And then there was another scary moment. There's like two scary moments that always stand out in my drinking, ending up in Newark. And I took a red eye flight. I loved, still going to the airport now makes me think of booze. I loved drinking and flying, and I'm from the East Coast, so I flew back and forth a lot. And I would always like drink when packing. Anyway, I ended up like taking a red eye flight and getting kicked off a plane, and I had no idea how. Like, they never took off, and I woke up in a Marina Del Rey hospital and had to call my nice boyfriend to be like, yeah, I didn't make it. Like, I don't know what time it is, but whatever. It was frightening. And a few months after that, I decided maybe I should. I Googled Alcoholics Anonymous so many times, never did anything about it. But I decided to go for it. And it was very scary. I had a sobriety date. It wasn't my first sobriety date. But in those months between sobriety dates, I met, Meg, I've known for a very long time. And I met her mom. And I met Kimberly. And I met all of you people. And I started coming to these meetings and hearing what I needed to hear. And hearing my story multiple times from the podium. And that made me realize I could have a life without alcohol and things could be fun. I remember like thinking, how am I going to go on a vacation and not drink? Like, how am I going to do anything without that crutch? And slowly but surely, going to meetings, listening to my sponsor, I surrendered pretty easily because I really didn't like myself. So it was easier for me to be like, I need to make a change. I wasn't reluctant, but I did have to surrender and I did have to make a lot of changes. And I mean, things didn't happen right away, but I started to be able to live without booze and without having, and things started getting better. That boyfriend stayed with me and we are married, and we got married. And I remember it was like, I was almost 2 years sober, but all of these great things happened in sobriety. We have a daughter and she's 3 and she's nuts. But, you know, but one thing, like last year, my husband and I went through something really sad where we were trying to have our second child and it wasn't easy. And then I finally got pregnant, and like at the start of my second trimester, we realized that something was very wrong with the child. And it was a really, 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 really hard time and a hard decision. And the first time that I was really faced with like, oh, something bad can happen. And it really did. But I remember that day talking to somebody, whether it was Kimberly or Megan, being like, I don't feel like I have to drink right now. And that being like, whoa, not only could I imagine like having fun and not being able to drink, but like having something that like really shattered me and not going to that place of like, I needed a pill, which like pills were never my thing, but like, I don't know. I didn't need something to numb. I just felt that pain. And I lived through it and I talked to people about it and I was pretty open about it because that's what you all taught me to do. That like when you go through something rough, you feel the pain and you just, you know, you got to come clean about it. And so I don't know if I'm pregnant now, it's planned. And which, by the way, is bizarre considering how promiscuous I was when blacked out, but a planned pregnancy. And, you know, I feel very blessed, but I also feel like, you know, being through, feel like you kind of go through the trenches in this program, and it teaches you what you need to know when you are going through good times, when you're going through bad times. And for that, I'm just very grateful. And thank you, Mary, for having me do these 10 minutes. I feel a little relieved that this is over, but very happy to see you all. Thank you so much.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Luis L.
Luis, alcoholic. I want to thank Mary for asking me to participate in my sobriety, especially here, even though I still wish I could just be sitting in my seat. But I asked for the last speaker's name on the way out because the only thing I heard was pregnancy, and then and John says show off. That's the only thing I heard in 10 minutes, Jessica. I'm glad I get to loosen up a little bit. It's what I probably feels great, because when I got here, I was really, really uptight about everything. I'm still am most of the time, but every now and then, you know, I get a little different side of me. My sobriety day is November 5th, 2005. My sponsor is Ruben L. I have had two good men sponsor me through my whole sobriety that I can actually, you know, be able to tell them that I love them. You know, it's them too and my dad, and without feeling, feeling weak or anything like that, because I didn't grow up like that. My dad never said it. Nobody said it in my family. My grandma had 14 kids, and all my uncles and aunts, I don't remember them saying anything like that, especially my mom. You know, I kind of grew up with verbal abuse, physical abuse, just the norm, you know, in Mexican families. And then my dad was an alcoholic, and I was a kid that couldn't stay still. I couldn't stay still at church, school, wherever you took me, I couldn't stay still. I was just like a pain in the ass to everybody. And I kind of understand now why, you know. I didn't see that then, you know, until I did my fourth step. My first drink was a bunch of drinks. Like when I was little, I used to open up the cans for my godfather. I used to live with my godmother and my godfather for years. And I would always take a sip of the suds and light up my godfather's and my godmother's cigarettes in the stove. But my first real drink was a hot Coors that I know my Uncle Marcos left at a camping site. And it was a 16-ounce brown Coors. And I was maybe about halfway, and I chugged it. And I was just mellow out, just looking at the creek. My cousins playing with paper boats, and I was so mellow and just enjoying it. And my body was sizzling. I was warm, took only a couple of seconds. I snapped out of it, and I just went back to what I do, you know, regularly. I just started grabbing some rocks and throwing them at the boats. And then I said, when I go camping again, I'm going to drink. So the next time we went camping, I had all my cousins gather them all up and said, let's go and say we're going to need some blankets, because they moved us to this room and they were all at the campsite because they were all going to party all night. And you started throwing beers inside the pillowcases and the blankets. And I don't remember how many beers I drank. I don't think I drank many, but I blacked out, threw up on the pool where we're staying at that room, in that one room. And then blacked out. And then before you know it, I was 11 years old. And then before you know it, I'm 14, 15 years old, started to go do time and drinking with a big crowd. And you had to drink wine around these people because you couldn't put a case down, and it would only last there for about 10 seconds because everybody would just attack it. And so I always had a bottle of black, you know, a Mad Dog or Night Train or Thunderbird, you know, in my pocket. You know, I was always strapped. I don't know, people mentioned stuff about drinking scope and stuff like that. And I've always had a hustle for alcohol. I never had a problem getting alcohol. And sure enough, you know, got the mother pregnant, a girl pregnant, and the mother of my kids. And before you know it, she's visiting me behind the plexiglass and taking my kids up to upstate. And then I come back out. And the only thing, Amanda, the only tools I knew to use was come back out, get back out, go to the GR office, hang out with everybody there, because everybody that have gotten out, they're all hanging out at the GR office. And we were all just get our money and get some food stamps and then just sell them for whatever. And then don't go home for days, you know. Anyway, so just kept drinking, you know, through my whole drinking, putting hands on the mother of the kids, putting hands on my kids, putting hands on my mom for pouring alcohol. There's a thing about when people pour alcohol down the drain that it just drives me insane. I don't know why. I just don't understand. Why would they do something like that? But sure enough, you know, I had to pay a lot of prices for it, you know. And within all that time of drinking and using drugs and all that, I never knew how to become a responsible citizen or just a half human being that can actually live in society, you know. And until I came here, you know, I hate when I hear from other people, but I'm gonna say it, you know, whatever I learned about being a person, just a half human person being, I've learned it here, you know. I got here with no tools at all whatsoever. All my tools were like, you know, I thought that's a man should be a certain way. And, you know, and obviously not, you know, I've done so much growing up here, you know, and I'm still growing up. I don't think I'm ever going to be able to, you know, hopefully be the man that I ever wish I can be or look up to, you know. When I got here, I stuck to the man, you know, I just went straight to the man, and I still stick to the man, you know. They're my examples, you know, the guys in the coffee crew, just being around them, you know, and John, and I mean, there's many, John Keefe, you know, I could say many, many names, you know. And sure enough, yeah, I learned how to, then what happened, I got out of the joint in 2003 or 2004, and then I was out there running for another year, and then I was just tired. I just went to go get some rest at Pomona Recovery, and went to go get rest at Pomona Recovery, and then and I got in that overwhelmed feeling on the ninth date about, you know, the feeling of, I never had a feeling of losing. I never knew how I felt to lose. I would always cheat even when I was winning, you know. I just never felt how it feels to lose, you know, and I got in that feeling. And then ended up, when I had about 21 days, I ended up at Wednesday night meeting. Ruben picked me up, and at the end of the meeting, he was chief of cleanup, and he goes, grab a dust mop. And I grabbed the dust mop, and then got off the car. He says, did you get a sponsor? And I go, no. And he goes, call me every day. And I started doing that ever since. You know, I started doing 7 meetings, 7 commitments, the yard, everything that we do here, you know, a lot of the things, the moves and everything. And and I've learned, I feel, and I might be wrong, I'm sure there's many, many other things, but I feel that my commitments have been the reason of the kind of man that I am today, because of my commitments. I don't know how, why, and I'm sure there's other many, many things, you know, and especially doing things that, like my sponsors used to say, I don't care how you feel, what you think, it's what you do that counts. And every now and once in a blue moon, he would like pull me to the side and he'll say, you know, I'm proud of you, you know, I love you, you know, and, you're a good example here in our group, you know, and then many times too, you know, I wasn't a good example, you know, and I've learned how to make amends. You know, I remember John used to say, you're like the master of making amends. I made so many amends. I just became like the master of it, you know, like just make them and then just, but then I remember that he said, he goes, you have to start learning how to change, you know, not just, you know, continue making those mistakes and, you know, people are getting sick and tired of you. You know, they come to me and people complain to them, you know. And then, but sure enough, you know, I got 1 minute, you know, my life is, you know, right now I have 1 minute, you know, because of what my kids have seen and the visits that I've done with them. My daughter's going to be 2 years in October, in November the 12th, sobriety. And then my son is actually at Pomona Recovery right now where I started. And he's been there for about 3 weeks, but he's been sober for about 30 something days, you know. And if it wasn't for you, I don't know where my kids might be at. So I'm really indebted to this group, to the man, and to Clancy, of course, for the traditions. Thank you.
Our main speaker tonight is Stevie G.
My name is Stevie. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks to Mary and the two speakers in front of me. That was amazing and great. My sobriety date, the only one I've had so far, is Saturday, January 11th, 1986. My home group for about 25 years has been the morning meeting on Moore Park in Studio City. I love Pacific Group and Atlanta Group. I've been in England for a couple of weeks at the end of September and the beginning of this month. And in the little village that I was staying in, I went to London for a couple of days and went to meetings in person there. But in the place that I was staying, for the most part, there were only meetings on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. Tuesday, I would stay up till midnight and go to Atlantic Group, which was 7 p.m. there. And one of the two Wednesdays that I was there, I got up to pee at 3:30 in the morning, so I was able to come here. That's not an overshare, is it? Okay. I haven't. All right. Anyway, you know, in chapter 5, it says our story is disclosed in a general way, but I don't have much of an imagination, and I respond to the specificity of people's stories. So virtually nothing is too much information for me. I've had a couple of sponsors. I had one sponsor very briefly in 1986 into early 87. Then I had Merle Edelman for almost 34 years until he died recently. It's not true that sponsoring me killed him. He was 89 years old, and now Jerry Schmalis has been my sponsor for a while. I'll say a disclaimer, which is 2 years ago in 2019 BC, before COVID, I was out of town at a meeting that I'd never been to before. And the meeting was, the room was set up in an oval with about 60 chairs. And I just picked randomly a seat that was open, and the secretary selected someone to read a page from As Bill Sees It. And then they went around in timed 1 minute chairs clockwise. And at 5 minutes to the hour, the person to my right shared, and they said, "That's all the time we have for sharing." And they asked for, you know, volunteers to help clean up, which I do often, and I help clean up. And I was putting away chairs and picking up cups, and a woman came up to me and said, "I feel so terrible that you didn't speak." And I said, "No, it's like a non-event." She goes, "Well, what were you going to say?" And I said, "Well, you know, two of the people, there were maybe 40 people that had shared, maybe 20 people to my left that didn't get an opportunity." And I said, "You know, two of the people said something that was really interesting, which was for them, alcohol was a solution and not a problem." And I said, "It reminded me of something that a guy in LA named Clancy Immisland had said in my second year of sobriety. He said, if you're an alcoholic, alcohol is not your problem. And if alcohol is your problem, you're not an alcoholic." Now, at the time, I remember exactly where it was. It was upstairs at Brotman Hospital on a Tuesday night. But I didn't understand what he said. I thought there was some game that the words were playing. And secondly, I didn't have experience to know whether or not for me it was true or not true. And So I kept it in my head over time. And as my experience eclipsed it, I found that for the most part, that was true. I said to this woman that for me, alcohol was a solution, not a problem. I didn't get into the heroin. Her head would have exploded. But I said, what Clancy had said actually came true in my case. And she goes, well, I don't agree. I said, well, that's okay. She goes, you know, I'm glad you didn't get a chance to share. So, like, and in about a half hour, maybe a lot of people go, boy, I wish you didn't get a chance to share at this meeting either. A lot of meetings say who you see here, what you hear here, when you leave here, let it stay here. I invariably violate the second part. What I hear here, I repeat all the time. Things that move me, things that are not in the literature per se. AA seems to me to be a program of received wisdom that's passed forward. I mean, one of our books is called Pass It On. It literally is called Pass It On. We don't have a book called Keep It to Yourself. It's a secret. So I do this, and I do pass on things that I hear that I think will be helpful to others or things that have helped me. So that's what I do. I always feel like I need a meeting all the time. I got sober, which I'll mention a little later about how I actually got sober. I got sober in a hospital in Pasadena. And there's a guy there, my friend Bruce, who got sober with me. And he tells this story about he bought a used car and he tried to register it at the DMV in Pasadena. And he got there right when they opened at 8 o'clock with all his papers, because he had a busy day in front of him. And it turns out that the seller's signature was on the wrong line. And she wouldn't do it. She wouldn't register it. So he had to go find the seller and get them to sign another document. And finally, around noon, he did do that. And he came back there to the same clerk. And the smog certificate was out of date. I don't know if it had to be within 30 days or 60 days. That's not important. But it was stale. So then he had to go get another smog certificate. And finally, just before 5 o'clock, after an entire day, 9 hours of trying to get this thing done, he gets back to the same clerk and he presents the documents and that impossibly long string of letters and numbers, the identification number. One number was wrong. And he was so frustrated. All day he had spent trying to do this, and he takes his keys like this and he slams them down. He goes, what do I have to do to register my goddamn car around here? And she looks down, because the sound was so sharp and so loud, and she looks down and then looks at him and then looks down again and sees his 2-year medallion. And she leans in and she says, are you a friend of Bill's? And he goes, finally. Yes, I'm a friend of Bill's. She goes, well, you better get to a meeting. So that's why I'm here. I go to meetings all the time. I mean, I can't be trusted if I'm not in a meeting. And a little bit about my story, because it's not, the facts aren't so typical. I come from a long line of non-alcoholics. Now, I've gone to a meeting every day for 35 years, basically, and I hear stories about people who have alcoholism on one side, alcoholism on two sides. Now that everybody's paying to get Ancestry or 23andMe, they find out, oh, look, it's been 7 generations. Everyone is an alcoholic. That is not my case. About 30 years ago, my dad flew into L.A., and he asked for a recommendation for a restaurant. I gave him the restaurant, and then I spoke to him later that night. I said, Dad, how'd you like the food? He goes, oh, the food was great, Steve. But what was really amazing was I had the best drink I'd ever had in my life. I go, really? What drink did you have? He goes, it's called O'Doul's. I go, O'Doul's. I go, why did you get O'Doul's? He goes, Steve, this is fantastic. You get the taste of the alcohol without the effect. I go, Dad, can I ask you a question? He goes, yeah. I go, am I adopted? So, anyway, let me just say one thing about the pandemic. I was reflecting on this because last year I didn't have to go to any Christmas parties. You know, it starts generally after the week after Thanksgiving. And in my case, there's business Christmas parties, sort of hybrid business and personal Christmas parties. I don't like them all because they combine the two things I hate, which are holidays and people. And invariably, I say the wrong thing. Like, you know, a lot of these times in this town, people get, until last year, they get DVDs of movies and they're voting and stuff like that. And they're all talking about, did you see this movie? Did you see that movie? And so I got, you know, I'm good at pontificating. And there was a couple that were talking about movies and said, did you see it? And I said, well, you know, I don't really like seeing movies on TVs. I feel like it's disrespectful to the filmmakers and they invest tens of millions of dollars and it takes a couple of years. And I really think that movies should be seen the way they're intended by the filmmakers. And this couple just let me talk. And then very quietly, the woman said, well, you know, we have an 18-foot screen in our house. It's as big as this thing. So anyway, I'm no good at small talk. I don't like Christmas parties. It was one of the magnificent things about last year is not having to go to any. On a more serious note, AA was built for Zoom. You know, when I have sponsees that start at the beginning, they ask, should we start with the doctor's opinion or Bill's story? And I go, no, we start with the preface and we start with the forewords to the first four editions. And the last sentence of each of the third and fourth forward, the forwards to each of the third and fourth editions are so beautiful and so germane to this. The third edition last sentence, and it's not like I'm a quoter, it's just that these things are so important, says each day somewhere in the world, recovery begins when one alcoholic talks to another alcoholic, sharing experience, strength, and hope. That's the third edition from the 70s. The fourth one, which was 2001, 30 years after Bill Wilson died. The last sentence says, modem to modem or face to face, alcoholics speak the language of the heart in all its power and simplicity. We were built for Zoom, man. And it's great to be in person. I mean, I have gone to in-person meetings since they restarted in June, but Zoom saved my life and so many other people's lives. And seeing, of course, it's great to see people in other than a 1-inch by 2-inch rectangle, but still in all, nobody was prescient. Nobody predicted a pandemic. Nobody knew about Zoom, but somehow the editor who wrote that preface, the forward to the fourth edition, knew alcoholics would survive as long as one person can talk to another person. And so, you know, so it was with me. And, you know, one of the guys I sponsor, I didn't even know in person until a couple of months ago. And when we finally met in person, he goes, man, I didn't think you were that tall. So, in any event, getting back to my story. So there's no alcoholism in my story. I grew up in New York City. A lot of you people don't know where that is because it's east of the 405. But I'm telling you, you go down that way on Wilshire, go east, and sooner or later you'll find New York. But I skipped a couple of grades, two grades. I came out to California to go to school, and there was really no drinking in my family. And But I caught up. I caught up with the people that were either a year or 2 years older than I. And that's how it went for me. That's how it went for me. I, unlike Bill Wilson and many of the original people and many people here, I was not a bar drinker. I liked to be in a room alone. And I wanted the least amount of distraction. And you could say it's just an illusion of control. But when I'm in that space, I just want the illusion of control. I want my world small, what I consider to be manageable. Literally, with I put tinfoil on the windows, that kind of small, and masking tape over the tinfoil, and duct tape over the masking tape, and gaffer's tape over the duct tape. I want real small kind of things. And I used alone. Nobody knew that I was drinking. I mean, I would have a drink. I would have champagne with other people, but nobody knew. I would start drinking before I met with people, and I continued drinking after. So the quantity and the quality of my drinking was different for me than it was for my fellows, all these people I went to school with. And so much so that I had accumulated friends in New York, in LA, in London, where I also went to school. And then in the first week of 1986, they started speaking to each other and said, something's going on, we gotta get to LA. And unbeknownst to me, they arranged to coordinate flights to come into LA on Friday, January 10th, 1986, and did what you would now call an intervention. There was no such name for it then, and it wasn't choreographed the way an Alvin Ailey ballet is. You know, it was, and it wasn't like going into a room in a hotel and you get rehearsed by an interventionist who says, all right, don't say the word you, only say the word I, and say how this has affected you, and, you know, don't cast aspersions or blame or anything like that. It wasn't like that at all. I was taken to a hospital, which is no longer there, on a Barrington Olympic called Westwood Hospital, and I detoxed there. And on the fifth day I was there, they said, are you ready to go? On the eighth day there, they said, are you ready to go to a meeting? We have a meeting at the Alano Club on Pico at noon. The van leaves at 11:30. And I was so eager to get out and go to a meeting. And I said, yeah, that's great. I'll be at the van at 11:30. But I didn't know if AA was covered by my insurance. And this was January, and I thought there might be a new deductible or a copay. And I knew that my insurance was paying 80% of the hospitalization, with 20% being covered by me. But I wasn't sure about the AA. I had a wallet with no money in it. I had my ID and my insurance card, but I didn't know if you had to pay for AA on the way in or they billed you on the way out. This ignorance is so profound and so baffling to me. Like, I would never begrudge anybody else for asking a question to which they didn't know the answer. But for me, as Merle used to say, you know, no amount of alcohol is going to kill you, but your ego would. And I couldn't ask the nursing staff on duty at the hospital. I couldn't ask the doctor on duty. I couldn't have called my doctor. I couldn't have asked the orderlies, the driver of the van, the facilitators, the counselors. I couldn't say, like, do you know how it works in AA? Because I don't really know. I couldn't say that. So instead, I went into, there was a phone booth at this hospital. Now, for the young people, I'm going to tell you what a phone booth used to be. Many years ago, there were these structures of wood and glass, and you walk in with these accordion doors, and there was a phone with a wire on it. These phones were so old-fashioned, you couldn't even send pictures of your genitals. And Of course, on that day, and I did call my insurance company, it was closed for Martin Luther King's Day. And I went back to the nurse's station. I said, you know, I'm actually a little too dizzy to go to the meeting. And I didn't go. I got transferred out 2 days later to a hospital in Pasadena, where until the pandemic, and except for 1 year when my kids had basketball practice on Thursday, I have gone to this meeting at Las Encinas Hospital every single Thursday for 35 years. And that's how it started for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. The stories, the identification, the amazing community of interest that I found in AA started there in Pasadena. And I've gone to a meeting each day. I try to get to a step study each week, a book study, men's meeting if I can, a speaker meeting at least. And I've done. There was a panel I had. I got on the third Saturday of the month in September of 1987. And there are people here who have come downtown. It's on Crocker Street, catty corner to the new Midnight Mission. And I've gone to that panel even before the pandemic. They ceased having the meetings there because they turned it into a place for homeless vets. And it's a violation of federal law to ask the vets to come to a meeting or even if they're alcoholic. But for years, I went down to this meeting. I've done the same things. I've had sponsees that mostly call between 9 and midnight each night. I've done all of the things that people have done in front of me. I haven't tried to carve it out on my own. The last time I was in England, I'd come back on the day before New Year's Eve of 2020, right before the shutdown. And there was a guy at a meeting in the morning that I went to who was also visiting London, who said something so great. He said, giving advice in AA is a form of abuse. And for the most part, I believe that. I have made an exception. There's one sponsee I have that is beyond belief, and he had an issue at Verizon. It doesn't matter what it was, but if you know, people have cell phones, they have issues with the phone company. And he went in there and he said, I want a new phone or I want you to cancel my contract. And the guy goes, I can't do either one of those. And it escalated. This guy is hot-tempered and former Marine. He's a little guy, but he's a vicious guy. And he threatened the guy, threatened him physically. And so he calls me up and he always rests on, it's like 50-50, right? It's half his fault and half my, this is in every situation where he gets into it with someone, it's always 50-50. I said, man, if it were mathematically possible that your responsibility would be more than 100% in this case, that's what it would be. But for right now, it's only 100%. And so you go back there and you tell him that you were wrong and that you shouldn't have threatened him. And because of course he went for the, you know, I'm gonna call the cops thing. And you ask him if there's anything you can do to make this thing right between the two of you. And he goes, well, I don't know the guy's name. I go, his name is unimportant. You'll recognize him. He goes, I don't know his hours or when he works. I go, that's also totally irrelevant. You keep going until that guy is there. And he went three times without success. And on the fourth time, he sees the guy. He pulls up, gets out of his car. And when the guy sees him, he starts backing up like this. And, you know, all those phone guys, they keep their phone on like a gun in a holster right there on their hip. And he moves to it to pull it out of the holster to call the cops. And my guy goes, no, I come in peace. He extends his hand. He goes, I was totally wrong. I know you don't have much choice in this. You couldn't give me a new phone. You couldn't cancel the contract. I was totally wrong. And is there anything else I could do? And the guy goes, well, I saw you have a pickup truck. I have some stuff that I need moving. He goes, What? That's not supposed to be your response. You're supposed to say, like, it's just nice that you came back and apologized. That's what you're supposed to. And of course, his first call was to me. Because I'm not supposed to curse at this meeting, I can't tell you what he said, but believe me, it was amazing. And he cursed me, he cursed AA, he cursed the steps, and then he came back and cursed me again. But anyway, so this is the thing. I've done all of these things that you people have told me to do in the ways you've told me to do it. Let me just give a broad sense of what I feel like AA has really been about for me, which is, to me, the most important word in the 12 steps. We don't have the steps up here, but the most important word isn't even a word. It's a punctuation mark. It's the punctuation mark that separates the two parts of step one, the dash, because to me, the concept of unmanageability and the concept of powerlessness, though they're in the same step, are entirely separate. And, you know, the big book in chapter 11 of Vision for You has a beautiful passage about every alcoholic will know that he cannot live without alcohol, and then later will not be able to live either with or with alcohol, and will know a loneliness such as few do, will reach the jumping off point and wish for the end. Now, not being able to live without alcohol is powerlessness. Not being able to live with alcohol is unmanageability. And that dash, therefore, has to be infinitely flexible to accommodate all of the maniacs like me and every one of my fellows in AA who do it their way. And it has to be infinitely long, that dash, to accommodate everybody coming in. And, in economics, they call this a debtor class. AA constitutes a debtor class. Everyone is in debt till Alcoholics Anonymous, that is sober. And there's never a point, you know, in most economic transactions, there's a point where a debtor either becomes a creditor or is neutral. You pay off a loan or something like that. AA every day it's not only a new debtor class for those coming in, but it's the same debtor class for those that are already here. That's my experience. I don't know, man. I don't want to give advice, but that's that's the way I've seen it over the years. AA celebrates its birthday as June 10th. And obviously it's just a date. It's a random kind of thing in a way. It could have been in the world I live in, whoever founded it, like Bill Wilson would put his own sobriety date, which was December 11th, 1934. And for all of Bill's stuff, he had the understanding that it's the second guy. And that legacy of Dr. Bob's, turns out it's not his sobriety date, it's the date of his last drink. I don't know why they measured it from that, but regardless, we measure AA's founding to June 10th, 1935, which it's just cosmetics, it's just a date, but it's significant in the sense that it creates the legacy that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. The idea that everybody can be Bill to Bob, everyone can be Bob to Bill. It's not really a function of length of sobriety. That's been my experience. I get stuff from people that are sober less time than me. You know, AA, it's funny because AA seems to erase issues of race, class, religion, sex, age, if I didn't mention that already. And I've never been in a situation like that. Every situation I've ever been in, whether it's a nonprofit or any other kind of business thing, there's always a hierarchy. But AA has no hierarchy. I mean, we're all trusted servants. We help each other. How much more time, whoever is timing? 10 more minutes? I don't think I'll take that much time, because the thing that I want to say about this is that selecting June 10th as a date is a propellant for all of us to help somebody else. You know, I'll stray a little bit from AA per se. My kids went to the same college together, and they overlapped for a few years. And in 2017, the commencement speaker was Mark Zuckerberg. And, you know, for people that know these commencement kind of things, it's always like they're supposed to be very uplifting, vaguely spiritual, and, you know, it's a call to action, basically. And Zuckerberg, who is as far away from being an AA guy as can possibly be, he, in the beginning of his speech, he said, you know, a lot of people are going to say to you, what's important is to find your purpose in life. He goes, that's not it. What's your purpose in life is to help someone else find their purpose in life. Now, when I received that information from him, of all people, I thought, you know, I know he's not an AA, but that's a vaguely AA kind of thing. And as he finished his speech, he tells a story, which I hope is not an apocryphal story. And he tells the story that when Kennedy was inaugurated on January 20th, 1961, one of the pledges he made is by the end of the decade, we're going to put a man on the moon. And shortly thereafter, he went to NASA and was accompanied by all the pocket protector guys and the scientists and the mathematicians and, you know, all the brainiacs, the engineers and everything like that. And he was meeting them. What do you do? What do you do? And then he sees a guy in overalls with a broom. And he goes over to him and he says, you, sir, what do you do? And the guy goes, oh, Mr. President, I'm helping to put a man on the moon. That guy, I started crying because of Zuckerberg, not because of Kennedy, and not because of NASA, but because it spoke to me in an AA kind of way that I hadn't anticipated. And you know, years ago, I went to Las Vegas to see a friend of mine perform for the weekend. And when he performs, usually is on Friday and Saturday. And I had driven up there, and he had flown up on Friday with his manager and his agent and his whole, you know, retinue of people. And Friday night after his show, he says, hey, let's go to a meeting tomorrow morning. I go, great, because I go to a meeting at 9 o'clock on Saturday morning. And he says, all right. I said, I'll pick you up in the lobby of the hotel. Just be outside at 8:30. And so he did, and I did. And, you know, there was no traffic. There were just cabbies standing outside, smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee out of styrofoam cups. So I weaved around all of these cabbies. And then when you got to the main road, it says right turn only, no left turn. I made a left turn around an island. I made a few more. And then all of a sudden there's the sirens. And I hear on the siren, stop the car. Stop the car and let me see your hands. Okay, I see your hands. She comes up. I've never seen a gun drawn before. She comes up with a gun drawn. She goes, roll down your windows and open the trunks. I open the trunk. And she says to me and my friend, she goes, everything work on your car? I go, yeah. She goes, turn signals, everything? She goes, because I followed you out of the hotel. You made four turns weaving in and out. Then you went around where it says no left turn. Then you weave three more times. She goes, you boys been drinking. So, perfect. I pull out my keys out of the ignition and I go, nope. We're actually on our way to an AA meeting in Henderson. At 9 o'clock, she goes, an AA meeting? I go, yeah. So she takes the keys and backs up, doesn't turn away from us, backs up with the gun. And she goes back to her car and checks my stuff. And I had to give her the insurance papers and registration, license, the whole thing. And she comes back and she says, all right, listen, you have to understand that in Las Vegas, 8:30 in the morning is like 8:30 in the evening. Or midnight, or 2 a.m. People drive drunk here all the time. She goes, I'm just going to give you a warning, but just be careful. And then she taps the roof of my car and she goes, and congratulations on your 25 years. I go, well, thank you, but it's 26. She goes, what? I go, yeah, yeah, that's like XXVI. And that one, the other one actually says 26. And my friend slams his hands on the goes, what is wrong with you? It's like, I don't know. You know, when they say, would you rather be right or be happy? I don't think that's a rhetorical question at all. But this is the thing. This is the thing. I wasn't trying to be an idiot. She said 25, it said 26. I just felt it deserves correction. So anyway, I got to go to meetings. I will say a lot of times at work, I do a lot of stuff that's on the phone with people, especially obviously now, but this goes back years ago. And, you know, I negotiate these deals. And when deals close successfully, if I don't know the person, I'll say, hey, let's have lunch. Let's have dinner. And she goes, that's a great idea. So it was a Tuesday night at 7:15. I was in my office. She was in hers. And just on the spur of the moment, I go, you have plans for dinner tonight? She goes, no. I go, all right, well, let's meet up for dinner. So we meet up for dinner. Place in Brentwood. And like the first 20 minutes is talking about the deal. And then I said, do you know this restaurant? She goes, no, I don't. I go, well, you know, I love this place. I love the food here. And I go, you know, even my kids and my almost ex-wife, you know, we love that. She loves that place too. They love that place too. And thanks. I see the 5 minutes. She goes, oh, you have kids. I go, yeah, I'm going through a divorce. You have kids. Yeah, I have kids. How do you do it? Well, I go Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, they're at her house, and Thursday, Friday, and most weekends are at my house, except when there's Laker games or the third Saturday night of the month. She goes, third Saturday night of the month? What's that? And I go, well, I go downtown. She goes, you go downtown? You have a subscription for Disney Hall? I go, no, I don't. She goes, oh, you must go to Amundsen. You go to all the plays at Amundsen. I go, no, I don't. She goes, well, what do you do downtown? I go, I talk to people. She goes, you talk to people? What do you talk about? So at this point, you know, I've realized I should have said, I don't even have kids. I don't even like kids. But instead, I was so deep in this. I go, well, I said, I talked to them about drinking, not drinking. She goes, drinking and not drinking. She goes, oh, let me just make a public service announcement. If you're in a situation like this where it's vaguely business, don't open with the heroin. People don't understand. So yeah, I go drinking and not drinking. She goes, how long has it been? I go, 19 years. She goes, you haven't had a drink in 19 years? You must be so proud of yourself. I go, well, no, not proud of myself. Pride is one of the seven deadly sins, you know? You know, pride, greed, sloth, envy. She goes, I don't understand. I go, well, you ever hear the expression being proud of an alcoholic who stops drinking is like being proud of a cowboy with hemorrhoids for getting off his horse? She goes, no, I never heard that expression. I go, you know, it's not that popular. But what it means is I'm grateful, and I am grateful. And I'll just finish by saying, because I'm in the last minute, every year since January of 1986, I get a meditation book. And over the years, I've had literally 35 of them. And, you know, AA got into that racket with daily reflections, and Narcotics Anonymous has one, and CA has one, Al-Anon has three of them. But one year I didn't have one, and I went into a bookstore, and I said to, I've never really helped at a bookstore, I just sort of browse. And I said to the guy, I'm looking for a book calendar. When I said that, I was like, what does that mean? And he took me over to the side where the wall hanging calendars are. I said, not that. And then he showed me the ones on the desk. I go, not that. I got very descriptive. I said, they're like 4 inches by 6 inches. And at the top of each page is a date. And then there's a prayer or an aphorism or a thought. He goes, yeah, they're called meditation books. I go, that's right. I forgot the name. He goes, you mean like the kind you get in AA? It's like, I don't want another copy of Daily Reflections. But I go, yeah, kind of like that. He goes, we have 3 shelves of those. just follow me. They're in the self-help section. So very quietly, I go, well, you know, AA is not a self-help program. It's a program of helping other people. And he's like, okay, asshole, we don't have a helping other people section. That's my experience. Thank you.
May we now have the announcements from our secretary.
Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Mary, and I'm an alcoholic. We celebrate AA birthdays at this meeting for every 365 days of continuous sobriety. We give a cake with the appropriate numbers of candles on it. And we define sobriety as freedom from alcohol, pills, pot, or anything which affects you from the neck up. If you are a regular attender of this meeting and would like to take a cake with us, please see me at the door before the meeting. If you're taking a cake tonight, come to the stage at the left and line up in order of sobriety. If you're taking a cake online, email Kimberly K, who's here, at birthdays@pacificgroupla.org by noon Wednesday's deadline. Hybrid birthdays will be shown after the in-person birthdays. We have a custom at the Pacific Group of donating $1 for each candle in our cakes. At the end of the year, this candle money is our contribution to AA organizations worldwide. So see my assistants at the door when you sign up to take your cake. And if you are participating online, please arrange this with our treasurer, Lon B, at treasurer@pacificgroupla.org. And now we will sing Happy Birthday briskly, and people will speak briefly. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear AAs. Happy birthday to you. Keep coming back. And our first birthday is for 1 year for Robert R.
Robert R., alcoholic. I'd like to thank Clancy for the structure, my sponsor, Sean C., my grand sponsor, Thomas Sales, and all of you. Thank you.
And our next birthday is for 4 years for Sammy S.
Sammy, alcoholic. Thank you, Mary, for letting me take the cake. I want to thank God, AA, PG, my sponsor, her sponsor, and the women I sponsor. Thank you.
Good job, Sammy. And both Sammy and Donna are also responsible with Kimberly for all the cake stuff. So they do a great job. We have one birthday on Zoom for 33 years for Ray P. And Judy Ross is his sponsor.